Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today. As we visit with Scott, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can post on Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And you might want to take a look at it anyway. There are already quite a few photos up, wildlife photos that people have sent. You can join there, go to the Larry Mueller Show and click like, and we'll send you some updates and so forth as well. Scott, welcome back. Great to have you with us again.
Well, it's good to be here as always. Summer seems to have sprung, and I'm sort of a short timer now. All things are coming together nicely.
Yeah, one more month.
One more month, yes. 4 weeks from tomorrow, and I'll be officially retired. Interesting.
But you're not going to retire from the show.
No, I'm not going to retire from the show or a number of other things in the department that I kind of have a vested interest in and a personal interest and so forth. So I'll still be around, but in terms of formalities, I'll no longer be on the payroll.
You're off the payroll.
I'm off the payroll.
Okay. Well, tell you what, I'm glad to know that you're still coming back the first Wednesday of every month. So we always look forward to that. We've got this warm weather out there. Finally here, we're getting some good plant growth, and the wildlife are responding, I believe.
Well, it's just good to finally have some warmth, especially for nesting birds. Well, we'll talk about what's going on in the Northwoods in a few minutes, but for example, I got some very good reports from my colleague with the Ruffed Grouse Society that grouse drumming counts, for example, and this is nothing final or anything else, but he said just anecdotally, talking to some of the folks who are doing the surveys, holy cow, drumming counts looked pretty good this spring.
Good.
When we thought we were starting down the slippery slope of decline. So if they were, or even if they were just average, and now some warm, dry weather makes it good for nesting success and the chicks and so forth, yeah, maybe we'll have good grouse populations again. So things like that are very much weather dependent, and hopefully it'll be good.
You were in Kansas last month. I want to talk about that because you were teaching what they call a bow workshop, and I think it's really cool. Tell us what it's all about.
Well, it is really cool, and I think one of the cool elements of the bow program is that, of course, it started here in Wisconsin.
Yep.
Dr. Christine Thomas at Stevens Point was instrumental in getting bow up and running years ago, and now it's all over the country. Bow stands for Becoming an Outdoors Woman. So it's essentially a program for women, strictly for women, who are interested in literally outdoor experiences, but are absolute beginners at everything from, hunting, fishing, canoeing, hiking, exploring all manner of ecology, plant ecology, Dutch oven cooking, wild game cooking was what I was teaching, along with a couple other things. Anything that happens outdoors is kind of fair game at a bow session. And this particular one in Kansas was at just a beautiful state 4-H center in Rock Springs. The Rock Springs 4-H Center in west central Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really impressed with Kansas, too, by the way. My image of Kansas, not having much experience there, was very similar to the top of this table. But in fact, it was anything but that, and it was really very pretty. I enjoyed it a great deal. But the bow workshop, I think there were about 50 women there. They have a bigger workshop in the fall. As I say, there were probably 25 different activities they could choose from. They were incredibly enthusiastic. And from the standpoint of, the longstanding issue of recruitment of new participants in various forms of outdoor recreation, particularly things like fishing and hunting and so forth, these bow sessions are really important because the female sector, so to speak, is one of the growth industries in these activities, whereas other retention and recruitment issues are a bit problematic. So anyway, it was a lot of fun for people here in Wisconsin, women in Wisconsin who are interested. They can probably just Google the bow program and or call Stevens Point and get the coordinators and find out what's being offered in Wisconsin for bow workshops. And I think there are quite a few of them. And it's just really a neat program.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Chris and Merrill has a question or comment for you. So let's go to Chris. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My kids and I were watching a killdeer in our yard who had developed a little nest. She laid 4 eggs. And we've been watching her this whole week. And all of a sudden this morning I went out to check on her. And she's gone. 3 of the eggs are gone. 1 egg is left. She's clearly abandoned the nest. And I found one of the eggs about 15 feet away, cracked in half. I'm just wondering, do you have any idea what could have gotten to her?
Probably a raccoon.
Well, any number of things, Chris. I mean, as you know from watching the nest, it isn't much of a nest. It's just a bit of a scratched out area on the ground, usually in a fairly open, you know, kind of gravelly or dirt area. So, I mean, they're out there exposed to the world. So survival of such nests is very difficult. The eggs, the whole thing is kind of cryptic, so it's not easy to see unless you've been watching it. But when you think about the number of raccoons, possums, skunks, foxes, feral cats, and assorted other things that are just out there wandering around, the probability is pretty darn good that sooner or later some one of those animals is going to blunder into the nest. Eggs for supper tonight. And that's what happens. So yep. I can't tell you which one got them, but it could have been any number of things, even squirrels, ground squirrels, yep. A whole host of things. Don't mind a few fresh eggs.
Yeah, there you go.
Any chance he'll lay a nest anywhere near there again?
Often for most of the smaller birds, they'll have a second clutch, especially if a nest is lost. Some of them will have a second brood anyway, but if a nest is lost, especially early in incubation, they'll usually re-nest. Whether it will be there or not, who knows?
Who knows? Thanks for calling, Chris. Appreciate your call. Matthew in Elgin, Illinois. On to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hi. How's everybody doing? Can I get you to hand just a second?
All right. What happened there? We lost Matt.
He's checking something.
He's checking.
Well, in the meantime,
I'll call this a far suburb of Wisconsin. We're about 30 miles south. Somehow we ended up with the Wisconsin Public Radio feed on our local public school system.
Cool.
And yeah, I really enjoyed it. Wow, what a way to get a view. You know, Wisconsin's a great state. I think all of our states are great, but mm-hmm. you really get an inside view. Like Mr. Craven was just talking about the Northwoods of Wisconsin. Well, where I am, I don't hear about that too much, but it's nice to hear. Any case, in my town, I've noticed, I would call it a 95%. If I had looked at a park and saw 20 squirrels, I might see one now. And, of course, over the last 30 years, we were exclusively red squirrels in this town. Now it's all gray. About 5-plus years ago, they seemed to become more diminutive in size. They're small, but almost uniformly smaller. Why is there 95% less gray squirrels in my town?
Hard to believe there's 95% fewer gray squirrels.
Yeah, Matthew, I'm not sure what to tell you because generally squirrels are so darn abundant that the problem is usually overabundance in the city parks and communities rather than underabundance. And for that reason, I'm wondering if there's a human-related explanation that
Did you say you used to work at Max McGraw Wildlife?
I still spend some time at Max McGraw occasionally.
You don't
yes.
think a bunch of people from Wisconsin have been coming down here and eating our squirrels?
No, probably not. We've got plenty of them up here to deal with, and
No, I'm not kidding. This is for real.
Oh, I understand, one of the things that we've tried to make clear over the many years on the program about wildlife populations is that there's a great deal of variation across the landscape, even with an animal that is apparently abundant, whether it's deer or squirrels or rabbits or a variety of birds or whatever else. Someone may be experiencing, hey, there's one behind every bush, whereas someone else said, gee, I haven't seen one for the last 2 months. And that's simply the way it is, and that's often a reflection of the patchy distribution of preferred habitat on the landscape or a whole host of other things ranging from disease outbreaks to active control in some cases by people. And for example, here in Madison on the Capitol Square, at one point there were scads of squirrels. I mean, it was a community talking point. If you were up at the square trying to have lunch, there were squirrels running every which way. They're gone. None. That I haven't seen a squirrel up there for quite a while. And that was a conscious effort to remove the nest boxes they were using. The squirrels were suffering, and they were mangy-looking things. There were simply too many of them. And there was a conscious attempt to reduce the population, which they were very successful at doing. They're hard to find now. And there were no essentially master or nut-bearing trees there, so the squirrels were dependent on human handouts. In some cases, it's just a slow and insidious change in the habitat that tree species that were providing them with nest sites or food are cut down and replaced with some other ornamental tree. I don't know what to say, Matt, except it's not uncommon to have areas where declines have occurred for a variety of reasons that you might have to dig a little bit. I'd check with the local park managers, for example, and say, hey, has anything been going on here in terms of anybody literally removing squirrels intentionally or anything else that would point to what happened? I've not heard of a scenario where the squirrels kind of slowly fizzled out by getting progressively smaller and so forth. That's a little strange and sometimes difficult to detect. But I guess we're going to have to leave it at that. If you can turn up some local cause or check with folks in the community, if there's an Audubon Society chapter or Nature Center nearby, see if there have been any reports, or even check with the Illinois Department of Conservation and see if there's been anything going on in that area with any disease problems or anything else.
Yep.
Eventually, maybe some answer will be forthcoming, but I can't give you a good one.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Good luck, Matthew. Appreciate it. Fred in Watersmeet, Michigan, you are up next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks, guys. My wife and daughter were out the other night in our canoe around 7 at night, and they went out our outlet, and the water's up, so they could canoe quite far back in the outlet, and it's a marshy area. And, of course, my daughter was in the front of the canoe, and I don't know if she freaked out or not, but she came very close to a huge porky.
Mm-hmm.
And but the thing that was unusual about this was they claim it was yellowish green, and that's kind of what the color of the vegetation is up here now. You know, it's not fully greened up yet. And could the porky can't adapt its coloring at all to the vegetation it's in?
No, they're not like a chameleon, but...
have you ever heard of them with that kind of color variation?
Yeah, actually, yes. I've seen them that way. Well, it depends on the sunlight and how it hits it.
There's a couple things going on. There's some variation among porcupines, and I think if you went to a museum collection where they had a scad of porcupines, you'd see some that range from blonde to some that are almost black. Typically, they're kind of a mottled darkish color, and the quills have kind of a whitish gray or silver cast to them. And that's what most of them look like. But for many animals, there are variations, and a lighter colored one is possible. And especially, as Larry said, when you get into the time they were canoeing in that late evening light, when everything kind of takes on this eerie, orangey, yellowish glow, the quills are kind of shiny. I can see them picking up some of that late evening light. And if she was startled by a monster porky just feet away, it could have, that could be part of it too. But
they said that it went down into the water. And
a porcupine?
And it was either swimming or the water was shallow enough it was kind of walking on the top of the bottom. Does that sound natural too?
Well, any animal can swim if they have to, and if they're pressed, they can get through water, and I'm assuming porcupines are no different, but they're absolutely sure this was a porcupine, right? You have no doubt about that.
Yeah. We've been up here for many, many years.
No, all right. Okay. Well, I mean...
It actually raised its, it fanned its tail at them, so it kind of gave that defense posture, too. So, in fact, our dog got a muzzle full of quills up here last summer. So, I know that that's what they saw, but I just was kind of surprised when she said it went down into the water itself, and it was either swimming or the water was shallow enough. It was, walking.
Well, either thing is possible. Up in the North Woods, porcupine or any other animal can't go very far in any one direction before they're going to encounter a stream or pond or something. And if they're not adapted to get across there, they're in trouble. So that's not too hard to believe.
Thanks a lot for calling, Fred. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Join in. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1000. 1-800-273-4. Give a call with your questions or go online to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post there or email at talk@WPR.org. Jerry in Green Bay saw a totally white turkey with a black beard. How rare is that? Should it be protected or reported, Scott?
Well, albinos and partial albinos can occur in any animal. There's also, of course, with turkeys, there's a bit of a problem with some domestic stock infusion in places or escapes. So I'm not sure what the origin of that particular bird was, but it's a curiosity. Anytime somebody sees something like this, it's a curiosity. It's cool. Maybe they get a picture. Maybe they don't. In terms of reporting it or anybody tracking it or trying to protect it, that's not very likely or probably possible.
Would you be able to shoot a turkey, an albino turkey?
Yeah, I don't think the regulations state a bearded turkey in the spring, okay. And this was a bearded turkey. In fact, I've seen pictures of people who have harvested white or partially white ones in previous seasons. So
okay,
it could happen, and it would have been a legal turkey during the seasons that just ended.
Wayne in Oak Hills, Illinois, to you now. Hi, Wayne.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have an unusual robin in our yard this year. It looks like somebody had splattered it with bleach or white paint.
Yeah. So it was a partial albino, Scott.
I guess.
Well, there are a couple of possibilities. Animals that are patchy white like that are usually called piebald. And it's sort of an intermediate, if you want to think of it that way, between a totally white animal, which or may not be an albino. So that's one possibility, that it was simply piebald. That's a genetic condition. The other is that occasionally some of these birds will, after suffering an injury or something, feather lice or mites, for example, that might remove some feathers, sometimes the feathers on a damaged area come back in white, too, rather than the normal coloration.
Oh, okay.
So there are a couple possibilities, but my suspicion is it's just a piebald robin, which is, again, a cool thing to see.
Yep.
and unusual, but there it is.
There it is.
No big thing. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Wayne. Greg in Bowler. Hi, Greg.
Hello. How do you do?
Thanks for calling.
In regards to the caller on the killdeer nest, I've watched killdeer nests, and if you don't catch them right in time, those little chicks will be up and running away with their mother.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so you're suggesting maybe the nest actually hatched legitimately and...
Yes. I
like that. I like that thought. Let's go with that, Greg. We'll assume that they hatched. There was one infertile egg left behind, and a shell got moved, and the three little chicks are off and doing well. How's
right.
that?
Especially if she found a egg that was broke in half.
Yep.
And that sounds like the way they would hatch. Second thing is I've personally witnessed,
porkies.
Porkies sitting in water. And eating large lily pads.
Ah,
there you go.
It was a very, very hot day. I was canoeing. The porcupine didn't even seem to mind me paddling by a foot and a half, 2 feet.
Well, driving around in Oneida and Vilas County for the last couple weeks, the number of dead porcupines on the road was shocking. So it appears that they don't really pay much attention to anything when they're out wandering around. So
yeah, and maybe if I could take this off there, if you could address the possibility of attracting flying squirrels.
Okay.
Of attracting flying
attracting,
squirrels.
Attracting, yeah. I live in the woods pretty mm-hmm. much and suspect that they're there.
Yeah.
And what would be the best way to try to lure those little critters into...
Well, I'd first say it appears to be a good year for them. Our students were doing some small mammal surveys as part of this field camp we talked a little bit about earlier, and it was a good year for their capturing of southern flying squirrels. So it seemed like it goes up and down with our summer field camps. This seemed to be a pretty good year. For people who are interested in them around the home, two approaches. One is to provide some nesting security in the form of either nest boxes that can be put up on trees, or encouraging, if there's a dead snag in the backyard or a tree that's on its last legs, finish it off by girdling it or whatever, and if there's a hole in it or a cavity where a limb's fallen off, so much the better. The flying squirrels may occupy it on their own. If you have no such natural habitat, then the wooden nest boxes would be a good alternative. But the reality is, if you're in a wooded environment in the North Country, there are probably flying squirrels around. You just don't see them. So that at that point, then, a feeder is a good idea. Some bird feeders will be used anyway, but I think a simple platform feeder, a shelf-type feeder that it's easy for them to glide in and land on and simply pick seed and disappear, is probably the most attractive feeder type for them. So if you don't have such a thing, put up a feeding platform, put sunflowers and some peanuts and assorted other sunflower seeds, some peanuts and a few other things they'd find attractive, and sit back and watch. And if they're a little skittish to start with, I know people have very active flying squirrel feeders, and eventually they ignore floodlights and people in the windows and everything else, and they just come and go. If they seem skittish at the outset when you turn on a light or whatnot, if you put a red bulb in or a red filter on the light, the red light seems to be a little less distracting, and eventually you can get back to a normal floodlight and enjoy seeing them, watch the birds during the day and the flying squirrels all night.
There you go. Thanks for calling, Greg. Appreciate your call. You mentioned that program you had with students the last couple of weeks, and we didn't really get into that. What primarily do the students do?
It's one of our forest and wildlife ecology classes. It's a 2-credit summer field course that we teach every other year at the Kemp Natural Resources Station on Lake Tomahawk. Of course, that's a beautiful place, as you know, Larry.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we certainly enjoy being there. So we had 17 students and 5 instructors this year, and we were there for 16 days. Just got back yesterday or day before. And basically, the students are there for 2 weeks, and their assignment is to take a 40 or 50 or 60-acre tract of northern forest there on the Kemp property or adjoining property, and they conduct a very thorough floral and faunal survey of everything that's on that piece of ground over the 2 weeks. So they're running small mammal live trap lines, they're doing bird counts, they're looking for reptiles and amphibians, they're surveying ground layer vegetation, trees and shrubs, doing bat misnetting, and all sorts of things like that that both give the students some exposure to the tools of the trade, the techniques that we use for surveying and studying wildlife, but also give them some experience. I mean, for some of the students, it's really the first time they've been out in the woods roaming around. So they have, and they learn the GPS units and use of compass and mapping programs and software and all sorts of stuff. And then embedded in amongst all that survey work, we have the DNR fisheries people come and do a program on fish management, and the wildlife services people come over, bring a bear over in a culvert trap and show the students how to process that bear before it's released. We go over to the Lac du Flambeau Reservation and tour the hatchery. We visited the Wildwood Animal Park there in Minocqua, and they got a behind-the-scenes look at animal care and that kind of thing, which was they really enjoyed. So there are all sorts of other things, plus nightly fireside chats with resource experts and things like that. It's really a cool program.
Oh, man.
We have a good time, and it's made all the more exciting by the number of bears around there now. So one of the techniques the students use is to deploy, I think they had 10 or 12 trail cameras out, very nice ones, and they had all kinds of bear pictures. You'd get the impression looking at the cameras, wow, there's bears all over the place, and yet only twice in the course of 16 days did any of the students actually see a bear. Once two students saw a sow with two cubs, and the sow and two cubs went one way and the students went the other way. And then once one of the students saw one on the road while they were going to and from the study sites. That's it. So, you know, for people who are anxious about, oh, there's all those bears in Wisconsin now. yes, there are, but it's not easy to see a bear. So the whole thing was just kind of a neat experience, and the students seem to get a lot out of it, and we have a good time giving them that opportunity.
Well, I bet. It sounds like a lot of fun to me. Dennis in Minocqua has a comment or question for you. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
You know, you were just talking about being up here and seeing all the porcupines on the road, and it seems the porcupine population has exploded the last couple of years up here. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the fishers, I thought, were brought in to get to lower the porcupine population. Has the balance shifted a little bit there?
It has shifted a little bit, I think, Dennis. Apparently, you're right. Fishers were brought in, you know, 50 years ago or so. But I think the prime motivation for bringing fishers back was to restore a native species to its habitat in northern Wisconsin. The fact that fishers eat some porcupines was not the prime motivation, although it's kind of a side benefit, I guess, if you'd like to see less porcupines. In reality, fishers eat just about everything they can find and stuff in their mouths. They're not very discriminating in their diet. But they will eat porcupines. So when these fishers were brought back, as I think everyone knows the story, the population just went crazy. Fishers did very well. It seemed like they were all over the place. And recently they've been turning up more in central and southern Wisconsin. But in the core, kind of the core area where they were released and the population boomed in northern Wisconsin, it seems like they've retrenched a little bit in numbers. I can't attach any numbers to that, but this is just what I've heard from one of the fellows who was really involved in the Fisher program since its start, that when any animal is reintroduced or introduced into vacant habitat, there tends to be a tremendous explosion in numbers if all things are good for them. And then eventually they get to the point where they've kind of overshot the mark a little bit, and then they begin to fall back. There are still plenty of fishers, don't get me wrong, but I think it probably is safe to say that there's probably a few less than there were a few years ago, and that's probably a good thing if you're a porcupine.
Yep.
Yeah, my dogs seem to think that porcupines are true toys. The other thing I found, your gentleman earlier asking about flying squirrels, I just used a platform, like you said, and I put a nail up the center of it, and I put a corn cob on there, and they come in there, and the wind doesn't blow the corn cob off with any of the other seeds that tends to get blown to the ground, and they come up there all the time. And like you said, I put a red light at first, and then now they're not afraid of a spotlight or anything.
So that's all testimonial that it works. Just a quick question for you. When they eat the corn, do they just take the germ end of the corn kernel out and leave the rest, or do they eat the whole thing?
They take some seem to just take the germ end out, but I end up with an empty cob. I end up with an empty cob at the end.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Dennis. Thanks a lot for calling. You mentioned bears earlier, Scott, and Deanie in Mosinee wonders if you can tell the weight of a bear by the length of the track. Her grandson measured one track at 10 inches. Can you tell the size of the bear from the track?
Yes. I'm just going to say that intuitively, you know, one would think little bear, little track, big bear, big track, and that's true. But as the students were collecting numerous bear tracks on their track stations, the people amongst the group who were bear hunters or knew about that, they were talking about, you know, 5 inches, and so yes, there's a definite correlation. And I think when people are hunting bears, they're looking at tracks. Oh, that's a good bear, that's not such a good bear, and so forth. So the answer is yes.
And let's see, we have an email from Lisa in McHenry, Illinois. We have a maple tree that's cavitated in several places, and a wood duck pair are nesting in one of the holes. It's about 30 feet above the ground. After the peeper chicks fall out of the nest, they walk to the nearest water hole. It's nearly a mile, and it's quite open. What are their chances for making it?
Well, the fact that they're high up in a tree, I think everyone knows they just bail out and the little puffballs bounce on the ground and they all get together and away they go. A mile's a long walk, but you know, we have to assume that the hen wood duck knew what she was doing here. If that was a particularly good cavity, and either she has experience there before, they know where the water is. Whether they'll get there or not, again, roads, raccoons, people, all sorts of things that might be a problem, but enough wood ducks make it to water in any given year so that the wood duck population is doing pretty well. The fate of that particular brood, we'll see.
Who knows? Daniel in Rice Lake, on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. Twice on McLean Lake, which is about 10 miles west of Minong, I've seen a large white bird swim by, bigger than the average size of a Canada goose. I was wondering if this could have been a tundra swan.
Well, there's a couple of possibilities. For one thing, if it's going to be a tundra swan, which used to be whistling swans, those are migrants. They don't nest here in Wisconsin. They nest way north and winter on the mid-Atlantic coast. So that's a common sight early spring, mm-hmm. and again in fall. However, the trumpeter swan, which is our native swan, the restoration program's gone very well for trumpeter swans. There's still not a lot of them, but there are many more sightings by people seeing individual or paired trumpeter swans in various places. And those sightings, if you thought it was a trumpeter, then the folks in the DNR involved in the trumpeter swan program like to hear where their birds are. They're usually marked. So I would say, when did you see this bird?
Yeah, well, I seen it twice this spring. Last time, I suppose, was about 3 weeks ago.
I think it's more likely you were seeing one of the restored trumpeter swans, and it was all white, no black on the wings.
I didn't see any black, but you know, it was just swimming by. So,
and the only reason I mentioned that is because another really big white bird is staging a furious comeback in Wisconsin, and that's the white pelican. Now, presumably, people know a big pelican bill, but at a distance, that's another big white bird that's going to become more and more common. But if I had to choose amongst all the possibilities, I think you saw a trumpeter swan.
Very cool. Thanks, Daniel.
Very close.
Yeah.
Last time was only about a week ago. I just remembered the time period. But this was really striking to me and shocking.
Yeah. But it's a great sight. They're fun to see.
I mean, they're big. If you're on land and there's a trumpeter swan standing, you're toe-to-toe with it. It's looking you right in the eye. So,
thanks, Daniel, for calling. Appreciate it. Tony in Richfield. Your turn. Hi, Tony.
Good morning.
Morning.
I want to register a success story taking Scott's advice about bats.
Oh,
okay.
Last August, September, I understand like August or so is when they have their little guys, and my wife and I had about six or seven in the living room at night, the babies.
Hmm.
And we hired a gentleman called the Batman in this area. And it was a marvelous experience, quite frankly. We actually kind of sad they're gone.
Yeah.
Well,
only because they're just very fascinating to watch. And they never bumped into us, even though it was, you know, in the evening, because they would get in there. They lived in the attic. We didn't know that. But mm-hmm. then in the evening, the babies apparently would come down the chimney, and we don't have a door in the basement, and they'd end up in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
But all they were trying to do was to get outside.
Right.
And so we learned how to get coax them outside. But we hired this gentleman, and he was fascinating in the stories. He's been doing it for 30 years. That's all he does. He said, don't take a shotgun and blow holes in your ceiling. just work with me on it. And he did it, the one-way doors you spoke of.
Yep.
And probably in 3 weeks, they got the idea, well, can't go back in there anymore. And however, one of them does come this. And now he's resting in the evening, but he can't get inside. But he's so used to the house that he doesn't really want to leave. But, you know, he can't come in anymore. But I just wanted to mention it because it was fascinating.
Well, I appreciate we don't hear often what the what the ultimate outcome of our advice is. So that's good to hear. But the other issue is if you enjoyed having the bats around, I don't know if you've thought about it or not, but you could easily mount a bat house outside, either on the house or on a pole. There are all sorts of plans available to build them, or you can buy them, and how to position them. You could have lots of bats flying around outside eating bugs and fun to watch and everything else. You don't have to tolerate them in the house. So that's
right,
something
right.
Something to think about.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for the comments, and appreciate your call, Tony. We have an email from Britt, who is with the DNR at Sandhill Outdoor Skills Center in Babcock.
Mm-hmm.
And Britt says, we have a 15-year study on porcupines at Sandhill, and we've seen our population decline at the same time we've seen our fisher population increase.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, also some correlation, perhaps. And since that call came in, I want to make sure if we can take a minute right now, Larry, sure. I want to mention that Sandhill, since the Outdoor Skills Center just came up, there are lots of great programs there for the public to participate in central Wisconsin. But in particular, they're offering a number of Learn to Hunt programs, and they're in the process. I think it's still there's still time for people to get in. But there are a couple of, well, let's see, this workshop September 24th, a Learn to Hunt program for beginning hunters, people who want to learn to hunt deer in this case. There are other such programs both there and around the state. The bottom line that I want to plug is if anybody out there, listening or otherwise, youth or adult, has an interest in hunting, but maybe they don't have a mentor. You know, mm-hmm. grandpa's not around to take them out. There's no one in the family that hunts, but they think, wow, I'd really like to try this. There are all sorts of really neat learn-to-hunt programs that would give somebody the opportunity to participate if they want to try it. And in particular, this learn-to-hunt deer program at Sandhill is something people might want to check into, or others there at the Outdoor Skills Center. And then that one in particular is followed up with an opportunity to hunt at Sandhill, which is kind of a neat experience in and of itself. So just wanted to get that in.
Very good. Let's go to we have a follow-up question on bat houses, so let's just do that.
Okay.
How can you keep wasps from moving into them? Into the bat houses?
Well, that's a matter of diligence, due diligence, whether it's a bat house. In my case, I don't have a bat house on the house, but I've got lots of peaks, and there are wasp nests all over the place. So it's just a matter of due diligence. If the wasps are establishing a nest, then you've got to knock it out of there. The good news is you can get these spray cans now with various, whatever the pesticide is. Phil could tell us about that. But you can blast that wasp nest from about, which I like, about 50 feet away, and it just knocks them down immediately. And then once that's done, you get a long pole and knock the nest down. Same type of strategy, but the difficulty there in the bat house, if there's any pesticide residue or whatnot, that's not such a good idea on a wooden house.
No.
So that may be a matter of attempting to then, if you see them operating, plug it up until they've stopped their activity and then get in there with some tool you can scrape it out with and start over again. But it's a maintenance problem, but it's just something that somebody who's got a bat house has to contend with.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some more calls here as we talk wildlife with Scott Craven, and Alan in Preston, Minnesota is up next, so let's go there. Hi, Alan. Thanks for calling.
Hi, morning, guys. Great program. I always look forward to the first Wednesday of the month, and Scott, good luck on the semi-retirement.
Thank you.
I've got a bird I'm seeing over here in southeast Minnesota. I work for a neighboring farmer when I can. And it's a bird that stays out in the open. It's about the size of a blackbird. It has a black back, a white belly, white tips of the tail, just across the fan of the tail. And on the back of its head, there's a tannish rectangular patch. Wondering if you guys can help me out in identifying that.
Black back, white belly, and it's just sort of hanging around out in open farm country, open fields and whatnot, the size of a blackbird.
I do not see it along the edge of the woods, and it's out in the edges, usually around the alfalfa strips and like road ditches. And when you come up to it, it flies away, but only a short distance. It stays very territorial to where it's at.
And you only, do you see one or more?
In the last couple of years, I've started to see quite a few of them.
Okay.
And well, it's not unusual to see 3-4 together.
Well, initially it's a white belly, dark back. I think a band on the tail. I was thinking about a kingbird, but this is another case where, you know, not seeing a photo or whatnot. This is where we turn to our many thousands of listeners who are excellent birders. And so we're looking for a blackbird-sized bird with a black back, a white belly, white tail tips, and a tan spot on the back of the head. And I'm sure this probably has a fairly straightforward explanation, but it's not coming to me right now. So birders out there, give us a helping hand here.
And Alan, stay listening.
All right. Oh, sure. It's always hard when you don't have a photo, so I'd appreciate it.
Well, that's a pretty good description, though, so we'll figure it out here by the end of the program.
Okay. Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I am going to turn next to Earl in Athens, Wisconsin. Hi, Earl.
Hello. I have an observation about snapping turtles laying their eggs.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, I've noticed about mid-June, they're out just in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday, I saw a snapping turtle alongside the road. I assume it was laying eggs, and I was wondering if their clock, because this is a much later spring, is not affected, and why they would. It would seem to me to be awfully early. Now I'm wondering if you had a comment about that.
Actually, it's about excuse me. It's about normal. I mean, typically around the 1st of June and into June, the turtles are out pretty heavy, and most of what people will see are either painted turtles or snapping turtles. Snapping turtles more obvious just because they're big.
Yeah.
So I was actually surprised. This field course we were just talking about a bit, we were watching very closely to see when the snapping turtles started to show up along the cut banks on the roads into the field station. We didn't see any. I finally saw a dead one on the road 4 or 5 days ago heading into town. So my assessment was that it was actually a little bit late for them to start. But typically from the latter part of May into June, they would be out in pretty good numbers. But it's warmed up so quickly, so fast after a long cool stretch, I would guess turtle activity is really going to be going hot and heavy here over the next couple of weeks.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Jeannie in Lake Mills, on to you now. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. That field camp you're talking about for the kids just sounded so cool. Is there something similar for adults?
The BOW program.
Well, the BOW program, if you heard that part of the program, we were talking about the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program.
Oh, no, I missed that.
Yeah, this is a program basically for, it is for women, basically who are beginners in whatever aspect of outdoor activity they're interested in. And different BOW programs offer a different suite of things to choose from, but it can be anything from outdoor cooking to hunting, fishing, fly, all aspects of fishing, archery, trap shooting, hiking, canoeing. You name it, those kinds of things are found among the different programs. And the BOW program, which is now all over the country, got its start here in Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And there's a coordinator for the program for Wisconsin at Stevens Point. I think if you did a little Google work or made a phone call up to the Point campus or just checked with the DNR office about upcoming BOW programs, you could probably find one you could participate in, and they offer all sorts of neat stuff.
Yeah.
Great.
And then as far as other things, some of our extension programs that we offer for landowners and other groups deal with some of the same kinds of things we were just talking about at that field camp.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jeannie. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to the BOW program that you taught in Kansas, Scott. You taught wild game cooking. What did you prepare for them?
Well, we did a wild turkey tetrazzini. That was very popular. We did a venison stroganoff.
That
was
like
pretty
that
good,
one.
Too. We did kind of a venison steak and green pepper teriyaki mix. That was pretty good. We took a good old Wisconsin venison summer sausage and sliced it thin and then spread that with a spicy cream cheese mixture and then stacked them up and sliced them into little wedges for an hors d'oeuvre. That was pretty good. What the heck else did we do? Oh, and we did some pheasant. What did we do with the pheasant? Oh, we made a pheasant pot pie that was terrific. It was just a really easy recipe with cream of celery soup, a package of mixed vegetables, some cooked shredded pheasant. Trying to think, was there anything else in it?
Man.
There might have been something else in there, but not much. And then put it in a prepared pie crust and baked it, and that was really good. So those were the things we cooked, and it was
good. You're making me hungry.
And I went to a workshop. I had one session where I wasn't teaching anything, so I went to a session on Dutch oven cooking.
Mm.
And the fellow teaching that was from the Panhandle of Oklahoma, And he still does trail drives and stuff like that with Dutch ovens. The stuff he could cook in a Dutch oven was unbelievable. The recipe that everybody there knew about, and they kept coming by, is the cowboy cabbage ready yet? Is the cowboy cabbage ready yet? There's another simple one. He rendered a pound of bacon in a Dutch oven, got it crispy, then mixed in a bunch of green peppers and onions, rendered those down a bit until they were translucent, and then all kinds of Cajun spice. So it was really spicy. And then he just slowly worked in three or four bags of shredded cabbage or coleslaw mix until it was hot but not really cooked. So it was crispy.
Yep.
And then he said, you serve that over a pulled pork sandwich or eat it straight. that was mighty good. So
that sounds great.
It was good. It was great.
Wesley and Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Wes.
Hello. I actually thought of a second question while I was on the line, so I'll just throw both of them out there pretty quick.
Okay.
First one was, when I go over to Menominee, I live in Eau Claire, in the parking lots I see seagulls, and I'm not anywhere near any kind of large body of water. I was wondering how and why they would get there. And the second question I had was about a bird in our backyard. It has a dark brown or black body, and its head, it looks like it was dipped in an oil slick. It's like a bluish, shiny sheen, and I was wondering if you might know what that bird is. It sort of walks like a pigeon with a small beak.
And it's a pretty good-sized bird, maybe the size of a blue jay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a grackle. Not a particularly desirable bird. A lot of people complain about them as they're noisy and they dominate bird feeders, and they have the unpleasant habit of nesting in big evergreen trees, and then as they're removing the fecal sacs from their nests, they drop them over cars and swimming pools and driveways and things like that. But that's a common grackle. And as far as the gulls are concerned, the gulls may find water when they need it, but they're quite happy in anything from a Walmart parking lot to a McDonald's parking lot where there's some French fries around. They are true scavengers and survivors. So landfills, parking areas, anywhere where there's possible food, you'll find gulls.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And we had a few people with guesses on that earlier bird, the black back and the white belly.
What are we getting?
We get four people said a bobolink.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yep.
One said maybe a brown thrush. Bobolink sounds more likely.
I'm liking bobolink. Yep.
Yeah, I am too.
That's the open country you'd expect, and the very pretty bird with that spot on the back of the head. It was on the tip of my tongue, Larry. It really was.
It wasn't on mine, but as soon as I saw it, I thought, yeah, that's right.
That's why we turned to our birding colleagues.
Greg and Montchez, let's go to you now. Hi, Greg.
Hi, gentlemen. Great show.
Thanks.
I had to go back to bats here for a second. I've got a colony in my attic that I'm wanting to exclude with kind of one-way bat doors. But before I do that, I want to put a bat house I got in a good location on my property. And I got a pole, and so I can put it kind of anywhere. And I'm wondering about siting that to make it most attractive to the bats once they can't get in anymore.
Okay, well, there are a couple of basic guidelines. There are no guarantees, of course,
right,
because you just don't know what the bats have for an alternative. First and foremost, one of the most important features is if you've got water nearby, that's a big plus.
I do.
Water nearby, near water is better than far from water.
My house is about, 150 feet from a small spring-fed 10-acre lake.
Okay, then you're already a leg up on everybody else who doesn't have water. Then in terms of the pole, away from trees, not in trees, so an open area near water, fairly high. You know, you'd want it certainly up out of reach of either people or a meddling raccoon or whatever, so 10, 12, 15 feet would be fine.
Yeah, I have an adequate pole for that. Okay, it's a telescoping thing that I ordered.
All right, so a good pole, you've got water, you've got open space. At that point, exposure, not so much of an issue because it's going to be in the open. Ordinarily, if you're putting it on a building, you'd try and get a sunny exposure. They like the sun and warmth, but in the open, you're okay there.
Well, I have a lot of trees around my I'm inset into a white pine right. area.
Well, if you can, you know, if there's a spot, just watch for a day or so and see where in that open area seems to have maximum sunshine, and then that's where I'd put it.
Yeah.
And if you can find somebody who's got an active bat colony, or if you've got some in the attic, and you can get, you know, a couple tablespoons of bat guano, put those in a little kind of a nylon stocking piece like a spice bag or a piece of cheesecloth, and thumbtack that in the house before you put it up. And sometimes the scent will, I mean, some people claim that that's one way to maximize your chances of occupancy.
Oh, okay.
So you'll be
all
in
right.
good shape.
Thank you very much for calling. Ron in Sauk City, on to you now. Hi, Ron.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Say, I just want to comment on that pelican issue.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Sauk City. I'm probably 300 yards from the Wisconsin River. And one morning last week, I looked up and I saw at least a dozen, probably 15, 18 of these beautiful white birds in like a bowl. They were mm-hmm. just circling
mm-hmm.
and not a wing flapped. They were just coasting on the air currents. And I had no idea what they were. And I looked and I looked. I ran in the house and I got my binoculars out and I saw the white tips or the black tip.
Yep.
And I thought, wow, those are pelicans.
Yep.
And I couldn't believe it. And then I started talking about it among friends and they said, yeah, I was out fishing, you know, and I saw a couple on the river and I saw a couple here and I saw a couple there. But I didn't know they flocked, for one thing.
Well, they do when they migrate, and they do when they're headed out from a roost to feed or whatnot. There's a big colony on a couple small islands in Lower Green Bay, and a flock of pelicans is fun to watch. They don't
absolutely.
Soar much. I think we're running out of time here. So, yes, people will be seeing more pelicans in the future.
Thanks very much for calling. Scott Craven will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Thank you so much for listening in. And certainly, if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, we have a listener who'd like to know, where can we find meadowlarks near Madison, Wisconsin?
Well, meadowlarks. Well, I'd go to an open grassy area, park, prairie restoration, something like that. Perhaps even in the Arboretum in the Curtis Prairie or out in the Green Prairie or any of the Madison parks that have got open space. And you'll usually hear them singing before you see them. The eastern meadowlark or the western meadowlark, their songs vary a little bit. But anyway, pretty grassland birds, but you've got to find some grassland habitat.
Yeah.
And going west a little bit, there's a big grassland habitat restoration area that the DNR and other agencies have been involved with for a long time, kind of in the Mount Horeb area and south in the southern half of Iowa County and some of southwestern Dane. And that'd be a good place to take a drive and see some, too.
All right. We got Mary in Chippewa Falls with a question for you, Scott. Mary, hello.
Hi. Say about 3 or 4, maybe 4 weeks ago, on the one day it was really bright and sunny and we thought spring was going to come the next day and it didn't. But I saw really clearly about, maybe in the middle of the morning, a bird 6 feet away from me, no farther, hopping along on somebody's front lawn and into their the little walkway, and so it was really clear to me what I could see of it, and it was about the size and shape of a sparrow,
mm-hmm.
regular common sparrow, not any little, you know, just ordinary size, and it didn't have a crest on its head or anything like a blue jay, but it was the color. It had that variegated blue, a little white, a little black kind of thing in its feathers, and they were kind of fluffy out, but then I think maybe, I don't know, maybe it was cold, and it looked a little scruffy, but not hurt or sick. And then it just kept, I was real still, and for about, I watched some more, and he had a white, completely white under, you know, breast, like a red robin would have, only it was all white, just really white, and except that it had two splotches of bright, bright yellow on the breast. Now, do you have any idea what that was? I was
bright
just
yellow.
Fascinated.
excuse me. Well, when I first saw the call here and it said variegated small blue bird, I was thinking about indigo bunting.
No, I know what that is.
It wasn't an indigo bunting and it wasn't a blue bird. There aren't that many blue birds, but when you start talking about the yellow spotting and the bluish only on the back and a different colored belly, then I think you should go to your field guide.
I'm thinking
some type of, especially that time of year moving through, there are a number of small warblers
that could
fit the bill.
Okay. Really?
Yeah, especially when you start to talk about a little yellow on the belly and bluish on the back. And there are probably several that fit the bill. And since you got such a close-up look at it.
Oh, I did.
Yeah, if you don't have...
Beautiful colors.
I'm thinking some type of warbler. Our birders may be able to help us out specifically here, but my advice is, since you got a good look, borrow a bird book from somebody or stop in at the library, nature center, online or whatever, and thumb through the spring warblers, especially the males, and I think you'll find what you saw.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Email from Mark, who says, I say birdhouses and feeders are great ways to see wildlife, but offer no real benefit to the bird populations they serve. Another in our house, I would suspect a spouse, believes they must be beneficial. Any scientific studies support either position?
Well, there are... So we're going to settle a household discussion, I guess. First of all, the observation that they are a great way to better observe wildlife is a good one. So the fact that people are taking an active role in home wildlife management by putting up feeders or birdhouses and learning more about wildlife and seeing more of them and so forth is a good thing from that standpoint. And in the long run, I think people who do these kind of activities are more likely to contribute to conservation funds, things like the non-game tax checkoff and whatnot. So it's a little bit convoluted, but there's a benefit to the birds and other wildlife there. But if we didn't see some benefit from these things, specific examples, well, let's take the wood duck, for example, and wood duck nesting boxes. I think there's generally quite a bit of credit and quite a bit of evidence to suggest that wood duck boxes were a key element in bringing back wood ducks from the brink of extinction a number of years ago. Same thing for bluebirds, as natural nesting cavities began to disappear. Same thing for purple martin colony boxes, and probably a host of others. So I think if you start digging around a little bit, you'll find ample evidence that suggests that well-maintained, well-run birdhouses certainly have benefit. And on the feeding situation, again, certain times of the year, early spring, early migrants back, late spring snowstorm hits, hey, the only game in town is the bird feeder, that there's probably some benefit there. Now, certainly a poorly maintained feeding station that contributes to problems like salmonellosis or some other things that are problematic when they're not cleaned, or they tend to attract the neighborhood Cooper's hawk and it just becomes a feeding station for the Cooper's hawk or the neighbor's cat or whatever. There are issues. But I think on balance, when you start to dig a little bit, the net benefit to wildlife by people being interested enough to both put up now I'm talking about bird feeders. I think we're restricted to that. If you start to get into feeding mammals, that's a whole different ball game. We don't want to open that can of worms. But on the birdhouse and bird feeder situation, on balance, whoever's supporting the positive impacts is going to win that argument.
Caller wants to know if it's legal to keep captive mallard ducks. Their neighbors have some in their barn.
Well, mallards are kind of certainly, yes, as a wild mallard population, but there are domestic mallards, too. So, not knowing what the origin of those ducks was, and somebody could have a game farm license and raise any kind of wild waterfowl, I can't say. So the short answer to that is there are certainly legal ways to have mallard ducks on a farm or game farm.
Carol in Nakusa, on to you. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I would like to know if I should be worried about a full-sized, very healthy-looking raccoon. Agile, runs when I holler or clap my hands together. He's visiting a backyard pond, and I have woods on three sides, but he's figured out how to get in an enclosure that has a deer fence around it, and he goes up over the deck and then walks down the steps. Should I be worried? He's been 2-3 times broad daylight like a half an hour ago.
Well, Carol, I mean, worry and concern are kind of a subjective thing. The reality of the raccoon business is that you may be seeing that one, but there are plenty of other ones around. So if there's something attractive there to the coons, like a backyard water garden that they're trying to find fish or frogs in or whatever, even if you were to have someone trap and remove that animal, catch and remove that animal, or even if you did it yourself, there are probably lots more to take its place. The only concern I would have is, you asked about being concerned, if it somehow figures out how to penetrate your defenses in the house and finds its way into the attic or under a porch or something, that might be a concern. If you see it out during the daylight and it starts to look at all weird, you know, it's wobbling or it doesn't seem to be able to maintain its balance or something like that, then that could be indicative of some disease concerns like canine distemper that you might be concerned about if you have pets. So there are maybe some reasons to be a little concerned, but you're going to have to eventually weigh the decision of whether you're concerned enough to want to do anything about it, like having it removed.
But as long as he looks healthy and it's daylight, that's perfectly normal.
It's not complete. I mean, they're active generally early and late and at night. Okay. So out in broad daylight is a little strange, but not unheard of.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Mark in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, I think I have a infestation of grackles. And I heard you talk about them before. It's the black bird with the shiny kind of head.
Yep.
They are messing up my pool.
So exactly what we warned folks about. So do you have some big conifers nearby and around the edge of the yard or anything?
The neighbors have some. They're not actually that far from the pool, but this is really the first year I've ever had this problem.
Yeah.
Well, what you can hope for is that they're still passing through. Although it's getting to the point where most of the birds have settled down and are nesting. Typically what happens is what I described earlier. The grackles will set up shop in a big evergreen, a big old Norway spruce or blue spruce or pine or whatever. And then as they remove the fecal sacs, the waste material from their young, they carry these in their beak and they fly away from the big evergreen. And then they get to an open space like your pool and it's bombs away and plotch. There goes the fecal sac. So,
yeah, they are quite large.
Yes. So that is a mess, to say the least. Now, what to do about it? You can treat the symptoms and try and figure out some way to cover the pool or otherwise protect it from that bombardment. If you don't control the trees, you've got a bit of a problem. Some people get so sick of it, they actually just remove the trees and start over with another tree species. Sometimes a good thinning of the trees may help discourage their nesting, but allow you to maintain the trees. But again, if they're your neighbor's trees, depending on your relationship with your neighbor, you may be out of luck there. The only other thing I could suggest, I assume the pool's near the house, if you can run a line, a fishing line, a wire, a cable, or something from the upper part of your house to a big tree, to the garage, to whatever, and cross the pool with one or two of those cables that you can then run something out on the cable, like a scare eye balloon or a couple streamer flags or something. The scare eye balloon is something you'd get at a garden center. It blows up like a beach ball, but it's got big shiny eye spots on it.
Okay.
And some Mylar tape underneath. That supposedly is disturbing to birds. And if you put anything out there, the eye spot balloon is just an idea, but anything out there that might cause the grackles to just deviate by 50 feet on their bombing run.
Yep, that's all we need.
Well, that's all you need, and that's going to protect the pool.
Okay, I will give that a shot. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. I see Gerald has posted on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show a nice photo of some bobolinks.
Aha! Yep, there and, they are.
Yeah, we're just taking a look at them right now online. So for our earlier caller or anybody else who wants to see what a bobolink looks like, there it is, right on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook
And they're
page.
Another one of those birds like the meadowlark someone asked about that are grassland, plains, prairie birds, open spaces. And, of course, that's a suite of birds that suffered a bit over the last few decades. So when you do see them, it's a nice thing to see.
John in Fall Creek, it's on to you now. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, I just had I was kind of curious about orioles.
Mm-hmm.
There's orioles all over the place.
Well,
I mean, does Smucker have a hatchery somewhere? Or?
Yeah, anybody who's selling grape jelly right now is doing really well, because I came back from being on the road for 3 weeks, and my wife said, good grief, I have to fill the jelly feeder every morning. And it's to the point where since I've been back, I've been working a little bit in my garden, and the male orioles have become pretty bold. They're 20 feet away squawking about where's the jelly or the orange halves. And, and Larry's done this too in his own yard. This time of year, they do seem like they're all over the place, and then all of a sudden, they'll just disappear. So it's a seasonal thing. It does seem to be a good year for them. If you've got a jelly feeder, it's a fun thing to see because they're very pretty birds. But you can go through a lot of grape jelly.
We had Noel Cutright on the program on Monday, Noel and Bill Volkert. And Noel had some friends who kept track of the pounds of grape jelly from 1 year to the next. And it varied quite a bit, but they had a low of 11 pounds and a high of 70 pounds of grape jelly that they fed to the Baltimore Orioles. It's funny. I was at, we've got a little neighborhood grocery store, and I went to get my some grape jelly there and the other day. And there's all these jams and jellies, and then there's this one big open hole next
grape
to the
jelly's
side. Every jar of grape jelly was gone. I said something to one of the managers. I said, you know, this time of year, you ought to really load up on the grape jelly.
Well, I think they ought to actually market it that way. I don't think there's much of an effort, but I usually watch come late winter, early spring. You know, you see these two-pound jars of house brands on sale for 99 cents or a buck and a quarter, and I just buy 10 or 20 pounds, and then that's usually enough to get through the season. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, Marilyn in Montfort, we go to you next. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. We also have lots of Baltimore orioles, but we've got indigo buntings coming to the feeder, and we've never had them come to the feeders before.
Hmm.
Is that unusual?
A little unusual, but they're so striking in appearance that this is the kind of thing that people with feeders live for. You've got a male oriole and a male cardinal and an indigo bunting and a rose-breasted grosbeak and a goldfinch, and it's like a kaleidoscope out there.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. We also feed woodpeckers, and we've got quite an assortment of woodpeckers, and I'm wondering if we've made a mistake because somebody has started damaging the wooden poles to our deck.
Well, I see the downies and sometimes the hairies at my own feeders. I've got a couple suet feeders kind of hanging on the spindles on the deck and whacking away at them occasionally. So far, they really haven't caused any particular problem. But depending on the age or condition of the wood, I could imagine them doing a little hammering that would cause some damage. But with that kind of thing, you have to weigh the benefit you get from enjoying the woodpeckers to maybe having to replace a couple spindles on the deck. That becomes a personal decision.
Yep.
Yeah.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had Anna Marie called to say that, with respect to the warblers that we were talking about earlier, we're trying to identify. She thinks that the warbler is either a black-throated blue warbler. Or a cerulean warbler, one of those
both,
two.
Both very pretty, and those would be good candidates.
Yep. So there's another guess. And we've got Jim in Ashwaubenon. Hello, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I live in a subdivision that's now about 40 years old, so we've got some pretty good-sized trees now. And this summer, we started hearing something. I don't know if it's a bird or mammal or what. Up in a tree, have not seen it. It'll go make a sound like tss, then a pause, then do it again. And it does it at night in the dark, like 11 o'clock at night it'll be doing that.
And this is during the heat of the summer?
Oh, it's doing it right now. First time we've heard it.
Well, and it has warmed up all of a sudden. Most, there are a few things that you might hear at night that are bird-related, particularly from some of the owls and a few other things, but most of the night sounds that are very persistent, once it starts, it goes on for a long time.
Yes, it does. Yeah. That's what I thought. Most birds aren't making bird sounds at night.
Yeah, most of those are traced to a couple of big insects that will sit up in a tree, and they're almost impossible to find. And the next time Phil's on, he can describe some of them. There's one called a snowy tree cricket, I remember, and a couple others. And they're just incessant. They make this repeated. If you think about it, it gets pretty annoying. Otherwise, you sort of tune it out, and it just becomes part of the night drone that you hear during the summer. But so
my guess was maybe a cicada or something, but I don't really know insect calls at all.
Cicada?
So maybe it is an insect.
I'm guessing sure it's an insect, and if I would guess Phil's probably got some recordings, maybe they could play on the show, and you'd get some feel for what it is specifically.
Yep.
But I don't think it's a bird or a mammal.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We got an email, or actually a post on our Facebook page from Gary, who says, it seems that we're losing so many of our great public assets to retirement. Scott Craven is unique and irreplaceable, and I'm glad to know we aren't losing him totally. Even though he's retiring at the end of the month, he's still going to be on with us the first Wednesday of every month. But Gary wonders, is there a new crop of experts we can expect to emerge?
Well, I have to think the answer to that is yes. In my own shop here in the Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department, well, first of all, I appreciate the kind words. It's been great to hear some of those things as I get ready to retire. But as I've been telling people, I'm retiring. I'm not dying, so I will. I'll be around. So that remains resolved, but. In my own shop, David Drake, who's been on occasionally, you know, filling in for me, and Jamie Knack, both of them have been around. David was the wildlife specialist at Rutgers University for 5 years before he came here 6 years ago. Jamie's been working with me now for 8 years, in almost 9 years, and runs a lot of our programs, does a lot of our outreach stuff, and was just working with me up at the summer field camp for the last 2 weeks. Both Jamie and David are very talented and knowledgeable, and they've already taken over a lot of the programs and have a number of programs in their own right. So I'm not at all worried about the future. And there are lots of great students coming along who don't even have jobs yet who will be entering the profession. So I'm not worried about that.
Good. Well, we have Judith, my producer, our producer for the show, saw an elk a couple of weeks ago.
That's cool.
Up in Six Elk, she says, in northern Wisconsin. The elk are kind of on the move now, aren't they, Scott?
They're on the move a little bit. There's been some concern about the growth rate in the elk herd up near Clam Lake because of issues with highway mortality and wolf and bear predation, some other issues. So the herd hasn't grown as quickly or as large as I think some people would like. So it's my understanding that they're actually capturing some animals now and holding them in preparation for moving them out a little bit from that focal point at Clam Lake to more suitable habitat, maybe between wolf packs, away from highways and so forth. So they're becoming a little more aggressive in doing some things that will grow the herd. So I think the future still looks bright. And it's nice to have even the number we have back after they've been gone for so long. So.
Yeah, it surely is. Well, there are other things we didn't get to, like the moose aren't doing well in Minnesota. We'll have to take that up next month with you, Scott. I wish we had more time to do that. I also wanted to mention that I'll be taking a few days off. I'll be gone the rest of this week and then all of next week, and Judith Sears-Poisson will be on the air for me, filling in. And doing her normal great job. So I'm kind of looking forward to having a few days off. and know that I'm leaving the show in good hands. So I'm appreciate that very much. Tomorrow she'll be talking with Chef Michael Fecker of Illinois from Milwaukee about how to make favorite recipes healthier without losing their good taste. So that's something to look forward to tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.